Hi folks, this is Rue.
And Dave.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Today we continue with Chapter 5 of A Wrinkle in Time by Madeline Lenn.
So, maybe I should put this forth to our listeners, but Rue has informed me that words are hard today.
Yes, very.
So, I mean, she's got an advantage in that I can carry most of our normal conversation, and then when it comes to reading, well, the words are already there on the page.
You're very confident in my ability to read today. I'm a little less confident today. it's a thing when I've been going through one of my friends and I refer to it as chronic illness Pomodoro. The Pomodoro method, in case you weren't familiar,
is one of those
20 minutes of work, having a 5 minute break, and then continuing with the 20 minutes of work, and so on and so forth. I call this chronic illness or disability Pomodoro, which is 40 minutes upright, 20 minutes vertical. Today, on a bad day, that's a bad day. A bad day, I'll be lucky to get 40 minutes upright. It has improved because so for dear listeners, I had a spinal ache a few years ago that got patched in 2020, and I'm hoping it is remaining patched, but I'm not entirely confident it is, because the symptoms are starting to build up again. So as such it got to a point where I could pretty much, I would struggle being 10 minutes upright without paying for it drastically. I'm not there yet. So far, so good. And so right now, it's just, if you're having a rough day, if I've had bad sleep, that kind of thing, then the tax that has is that, for example, today is not a great day with words, and it gets worse the more I'm upright. And if I'm upright for 40 minutes, this morning at least, I had the 40 minutes up, 20 minutes down, 40 minutes up, 20 minutes down. And so we joked, and we said, chronic illness Pomodoro, that is our myth now. It's usually a summer thing as well, because as it gets hot, we've mentioned this on previous podcasts, it's for some people their nervous system just goes, what is this, and freaks out.
Yeah.
It's like, the computer is overheating, please. Or like when your phone, if you ever had your phone give you that warning, more so in Australia most likely, but never mind, when your phone's been in the sun, direct sunlight, for longer than say 5 minutes, especially in your car, it will literally give you a black screen and an exclamation mark and a phone is overheating. Switch off or immediately cool down to prevent further damage.
Oh, I've never seen that. I guess I've been lucky.
I've seen it many, many times. I don't recommend, but I also used to have a phone that would overheat like at, if you looked at it funny. So,
I've been there. I had a iPhone 4S for like 6 years, and by the end of it, you know, I could just like, be looking at the text message app, holding it in my hands, and suddenly my hands are burning.
Yes, no, that sounds about, I think it might have been the 4S actually. This is not an advertisement, it's not an anti-advertisement, it was just, it happens to be that kind of phone. I think that was one of them that was pretty bad. But yeah. It's the thing. So right now my brain is, I think, overheating, and there might be other stuff going on. And hence, although I am conversing now, in the middle of things, I'll suddenly forget words, and you won't hear this because Dave will have edited it out. I'll mispronounce a word completely, so much so that it's a completely different expression.
Well, I mean, and she does this to me when I read as well. We act as producer when we go through the reading. So if there is mispronunciations, if we miss words, if there's a typo on one side and not on the other, you know, basically we make sure the read goes as smoothly as possible for you folks listening.
Yes, yes. Bless the editor. Bless the editor. Thank you, Dave. Thank you.
So I do my best.
Oh, the other day, by the way, remember we had a discussion of in the expression indefatigable, right? And we had like, well, it's fatigue, right? Well, yeah. And we're like, well, it would be indefatigable. And I've looked it up in the meantime because I've had to record it for something else. And it's like indefatigable. I'm like, but why? Why?
I mean, it does sound better when you say it that way.
But it doesn't make the sense. It does anyway. But I don't know if that's maybe a British versus American pronunciation thing. I forgot to check the American one. But the English pronunciation is apparently indefatigable. And I went, right. So that time we edited, I gave the wrong advice. But I've always read it as indefatigable. So apologies to all the listeners who did know how it was meant to be pronounced for that one sentence somewhere a long time ago.
It was probably catch 22.
Probably catch 22
That
does
sounds
sound
like a
like
catch 22 word.
it does sound like a like one of the brass being called like that indefatigable persistent like belief in themselves or something like that. Yeah, it sounds right. Sounds about right.
The one I
But
always
yeah.
find odd is incorrigible.
Oh, yeah. I always remember it as incorrigible, and no, that's not right, but incorrigible sounds right. Google has introduced a new, well, I mean, it's not new anymore, but a pronunciation guide thing where you can write, pronounce the word, and it will give you a guide. Like, it will actually give you the two options of British and American pronunciation. Doesn't account for Australian pronunciation or other languages, but you know. And I was like, when reading through documents and recording them, some like academic more things. I've gotten to the habit of like, I know I'd pronounce it this way, but let me just double check. Because I don't know. No.
And I think it's always, a point of personal pride, like, and I'm probably going to get this wrong, so I'm going to preface me saying that I'll get it wrong. But in December, I read The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. And I think I was a third into the book when finally I went to Google and I'm like, how do you pronounce Karamazov? Because I was like, is it Karamazov, Karamazov, And
It's
Karamazov seemed to be the one that came back the most, but it still sounds a bit off to me. I mean, I don't speak Russian, so,
that probably is the factor that is the challenge here, that not, unless you speak Russian, you wouldn't necessarily know how to pronounce a name that is in Russian.
I'll just say, not to get too into the book, but it was, I think it was really good. It's often regarded as his best work. And I'd recommend it if you ever, if any of you get a hankering for Russian literature. Maybe try Crime and Punishment first, because I read that a few years ago and really enjoyed that one. This one's it has similar themes, but it's more, it's like, well, it's a story about three brothers and their terrible,
Sorry.
terrible father.
Sorry.
But yeah, it's it was a 700-page book, so it did take me like a month and a half.
Oof.
And
Yeah.
I can only do one of those like once a year. Usually, I have one big novel per year, and then I pepper it with shorter, punchier things.
That is a chunky novel. Yeah. Actually, yeah, you mentioned before we were recording, you mentioned that you read King Lear over the
Yeah,
weekend.
I wouldn't call that like punchier, but that only took me a couple days to read. Well, 3 days to read, because those plays are usually fairly short. So I
But the
mount
language is
this.
dense.
Yes. Speaking of the language, I've gotten to a point now where the only way I can actually follow the kind of the plot and character of a Shakespeare play is to read it out loud. So hearing the word, the cadence and the language coming back at me conveys actually like what's going on. Like there's points in Act Five of King Lear where like they were setting up, kind of at the start there was a setup for a larger tragedy that was probably inevitable, And I understood what he was doing. It hit so much harder because I was able to parse that from the language. Whereas there were parts in Act 2 or Act 3 where I just was reading, you know, in my head, and whole sections kind of passed me by.
Yeah, no, that makes sense, though, also because of the fact that they are structured as plays. So that's probably by design as well. That's intentional.
Yeah, I've been told, you know, Shakespeare is the best way to study drama as an actor because the only way the plot is being driven forward is through dialogue.
Mm. No, I've been reading, a whole chunk of Scottish crime stories. Like, I think I started on, I can't tell you, I'll find out, but I think Friday I started reading by an author, J.D. Kirk. He's actually a children's book author under a different name. And then he thought, I wonder if I can write some adult fiction, some crime stories. Writes crime stories under the other name, and they are incredibly... They're crime stories, okay? And they're set in Scotland, and not just Scotland, but usually in the Highlands.
Hmm.
And it's very well crafted. Like, the characters are well crafted. They've got there's flaws, there's strengths, there's, I mean, it's well done. Like, I think if someone liked the crime hunting aspect of the Dresden Files, they'd probably enjoy that part of it. It's not like, it's not fantasy. It's not that kind of thing.
But
if you enjoy that kind of banter and working through different personalities and people working together with different, different characters working together, as well as actually crime solving, and as well as a main character that is flawed and also feels immense guilt a lot of the time.
Is there banter?
A lot of good banter. Great banter. Far too many Scottish swear words that I have now been familiarized with. And now I keep having to, and my brain hears it in a Scottish accent too.
Mm.
Because I watch things like Shetland, or I'll watch, like, I used to watch the old crime, criminal television, investigative things, but mostly a lot of them was set in Scotland or with a Scottish lead. And so it's pretty well done. He's got a couple of series. I haven't started the other ones. I've been looking at the DCI Logan series, and I think I started, I want to actually know when I started, because I'm now in book 8. I'm in book 8 now. It's been my in-between things book. So I've been kind of reading a couple of pages and then going and doing my work, and then reading a couple of pages and going and doing something else, or I don't know, but it's pretty funny.
And by a couple of pages, you mean like chapters go by and you're like, oh wait, I need to do other things.
Well, no, I time myself. I'll say, okay, you're allowed to read for an hour now, and then you get back to work. You're allowed to read for the next 20 minutes whilst you're having a break. That's your break. You have your tea, sip your tea, read your book, then get back to tidying your office or whatever it was. So I started reading this one. What did I read? I want to say I started on the second, but I might be wrong. It should tell me. It should tell you what books you started reading when.
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it's fairly much a 2022 thing.
Yeah, I don't think I read... Oh, wait, no, I did start them end of last year, possibly, unless it's counted the... Because I grabbed the omnibus. So unless it's counted... Yes, it has. It's counted the collection of 3 books as one book.
Hmm.
So occasionally when I look at my reading count and I go, oh, I only read 100 and something books in that year, I've got to remember, no. It's counting those collections of, you know, where they have the 12 novels in one. It's counting that as one, right?
Only read 100 or so books. Only.
Well, last year was only 139.
Oh, jeez. Only.
I say only because, look, and the books weren't not particularly, like, heavy-hitting books.
Doesn't matter.
There's a book of, like, one of them, the collection's, like, 18 books, another one's like 5 books. I'm like, okay, apparently not 139. The number's probably off.
You love the omnibuses.
I do enjoy the omnibuses because that way I don't have to go and find the next book in the series.
And I will say, actually, because often the omnibuses can be cheaper to try and get people into the series. Like, Rue yes. recommended me this fantasy series she enjoyed, and she sent me a link, and it was an omnibus of the first three books, and it was like 99 cents for that. But me being me, stubborn when I don't need to be, I'm like, well, look, I don't know if I'm going to like this series, so I just want to read the first book. So I went out and paid a few dollars more just for the first book, which in my mind was a good call, because while I didn't dislike the series, nothing about that book made me want to read the second.
Okay, fair. I think that was also a series where I said, you know, it warms up. The first book is slow, and then it warms up. But it's all good. I think that's one another reason I'll read an omnibus, because I know that sometimes an author is still finding their feet in the first book.
For me, like with Dresden, a lot of fans will say those first two books are rough and you have to get through them. Whereas for me, like Stormfront impressed me so much. I enjoyed that book so much that I was instantly on board.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing as well, though. It's going to be the style, the way, even in their roughest form or whilst they're finding their feet, that style that hooks you and going, oh, I think there's potential here. I've had it the other way around as well, where I'll read the first couple of books and they're really good, or they're really, they're effective at pulling me in, and I'll read those few books and then I go, okay, you have given up in the middle of this, in the like the next book in the series. You don't like these characters anymore. You don't want to write about these characters anymore. So you're just kind of reducing them and hollowing them out. And I might upset a few people when I say this, but I feel that if anyone's familiar with the Pern author, Anne McCaffrey, she does that. She did that. She's passed away since, but she did that. She had characters that were like, you were invested in them. You did want to know what happened. But then after some time, and this is predominantly the female characters, I will say, they became kind of shrewish. They became, as they aged, she was a little bit funny when it came to aging female characters. And made them almost bitter and resentful and harsh. And I don't know what that was about. And I'm sure there is a reason, but there was a pattern. And it's not always the case. Some cases it's not that way. Some cases it is, but there was something about, I've noticed that like it was sitting there, and I don't think I'm the only one who noticed. I'm sure some other people have been discussing it and commenting on it, because it is a thing where you're going, oof, yeah. And it's interesting to see it though, when it happens, because it means that maybe the authors either have, they're over the character, or they're letting the character be colored by their experiences or their existence. I know that the guy that I'm reading, J.D. Kirk, he one of the books was set on a small Scottish island and like an isolated island, and there was a murder. So obviously these are crime books, so there's murders. That's what this is all about. It's murders and abductions usually. And one of the interesting things that I noticed was he wrote in the end, he kind of, you know, the author blurb at the end where he goes and say, when I was writing this, I had to be careful because setting books in the Scottish Isles, where the communities, there are communities where you've only got, say, seven people living on an island. So your characters, you have to be very careful when you write about Scottish islands or smaller isolated communities, because if you write a certain character and it sounds like someone else on an existing island,
right,
that could be some awkward stuff there, and that's not good. So what he did was like, I made up an island. I made up an island name that doesn't exist, so no one can go and say, oh, this is what it's based on. So yeah. And he said, and I based it on characters that I'd experienced across different settings. Because this is someone who actually lives in these communities. So, and that's probably actually why it's such a well-written, like I find it's a well-written series. And I mean, I'm in book eight now, and we're not even in the second week of the year, and I've gone through eight of his books. And that's not all the books I've read. Oh gosh, yeah. So it's been very. That's the digital books. That's not the physical books. I'm reading other books, and not necessarily novels, but most of them. Let's be fair, the novels. Yeah, it's interesting. I think that's possibly, the whole write what you know about. If you are a person who lives in a certain culture in that setting, and you write within that culture and setting, I think that's possibly one of the parts why there's an appeal to it, because you read these characters and they seem alive. If you can write that way, then you've hit that sweet spot of you've created fictional characters, but they're not, but they feel real enough that they could be a person, like you could imagine them being a person. So it's really, I hope for his sake, if he does want this to become a television series, it becomes one, because I think it'd be a really good one. Probably MA, but still, it'd be a good series. MA because of the content and because of the language use.
Now, would they cast David Tennant as the lead?
No, he would not suit the lead at all.
You think Madeline
So, yeah.
Lang hung around people like Mrs. What's It and Mrs. Who and Mrs. Which?
Maybe not, but I think she possibly. The characters, I mean, her characters are fairly real feeling. At least you've got the adolescent Meg and Calvin. And I mean, yeah, Charles Wallace to some extent as well. And I do wonder if it's inspired by interactions with children that she knows. I don't know if, I can't remember if she had her own kids. I think she might have.
Well, I mean, to me, it does feel archetypical, the idea that, especially in a coming of age story, usually your main character doesn't feel like they belong.
Yeah.
You
I mean,
do have
yes.
that idea of someone who has gifts that people don't understand.
Yes, I mean, some of it is this, bearing in mind this is set in the 60s, so this is one of the early books of that kind of nature. So this is probably one of the authors you would imagine who actually set the foundation for what we now consider to be the template for these books. This is one of the earliest science fiction, one of the earliest science fiction novels that involves adolescents coming of age.
The first
There's
YA
not,
novel.
no, it obviously not, because look, C.S. Lewis and a fair few others, and there may be more children's novels, but they also have a certain amount of coming of age to them. So, Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe. There would have been some by, I don't know where Enid Blyton falls into this timeline, but she did some less coming of age, more crime mysteries and some other things. But yeah. And of course, the children's fantasy books like The Wishing Chair and things like that. But yeah, I'd be curious to know in terms of the sequence of storytelling. We had Ellen Montgomery, who had the Anne of Green Gables series. She had some series where they would be. I mean, even in Anne, there was a moment where she had an uncanny moment. Yeah. She had that uncanny moment of that dream and being like stressed and or knowing something, that she uses the uncanny kind of concepts in some of her novels, where there's dreams or a predictive kind of nature or just that the something that is slightly, I guess, the unseelie, if you want to go with the Irish concept, but in the island that it's set on for her series, for example, that wouldn't be surprising given, again, Scottish PEI is heavily, it's considered to be very heavily influenced by the Scottish culture. Which Montgomery should give you an indication, it's not surprising with that surname. But yeah, that kind of thing is, we see. But I think, I don't know, I'd like to look it up, and I probably will, but I think that Madeline Lang is one of those very first authors that came in with this template that now, well, that story that now forms part of the template of what is now the young adult kind of genre of novels. I mean, also Ursula Le Guin is another one where those templates or those cornerstones of young adult literature or coming of age literature these are these authors, which is good to reflect on as well, because we now look at it and go, oh yeah, well, she's typical teen, da da da. Yes, but this was literally one of the first books that gave this concept. So yeah. But so last week
there was a dark thing.
A dark thing, and the kids are freaked out. Well,
Calvin mostly, I think.
Calvin immediately is identifying it as it's evil. Let's get away from it. Meg is not happy. Meg is also afraid of it, but at the same time needs to know what it is, which falls in line with her mind.
They're also placated by the fact that they are in another galaxy and there are centaur creatures.
Mm-hmm.
There's
something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if this is like a manifestation of the ultimate evil, well, they've had their minds taken off it just by the fact that they're in such an extraordinary location.
Yes, and also I think they feel safe around the Misses. So Mrs. Who, Mrs. What's It, and Mrs. Witch makes, like, they feel safe around them. They feel protected by them. And I think that's part of the story as well. That we've been given so far, that they feel safe around them. That there is trust, maybe not implicit 100% trust yet from all of them, but there's a certain safety and trust that they do feel.
Hmm. Well, so far. Shall we see what the Tesseract is? Hopefully, because this chapter is called the Tesseract, we will find out.
Or it could be like Catch-22, and the title has nothing to do. We'll get there. Hopefully it won't be. But yes. Just to recap, in the previous chapter, the sentence that it ended on was Meg asking Mrs. Witch, "That dark thing we saw," she said, "is that what my father is fighting?" Yep. So, 5, the Tesseract. "Yes," Mrs. Witch said. "He is behind the darkness, so that even we cannot see him." Meg began to cry, to sob aloud. Through her tears, she could see Charles Wallace standing there, very small, very white. Calvin put his arms around her, but she shuddered and broke away, sobbing wildly. Then she was enfolded in the great wings of Mrs. Watsit, and she felt comfort and strength pouring through her. Mrs. Watsit was not speaking aloud, and yet, through the wings, Meg understood words. "My child, do not despair. Do you think we would have brought you here if there were no hope? We are asking you to do a difficult thing, but we are confident that you can do it. Your father needs help. He needs courage, and for his children, he may be able to do what he cannot do for himself." "Now," Mrs. Witch said, "are we ready?" "Where are we going?" Calvin asked. Again, Meg felt an actual physical tingling of fear as Mrs. Witch spoke. "We must go behind the shadow." "But we will not do it all at once," Mrs. Watsit comforted them. "We will do it in short stages." She looked at Meg. "Now we will tesser. We will wrinkle again. Do you understand?" "No," Meg said flatly. Mrs. Watsit sighed. "Explanations are not easy when they are about things for which your civilization still has no words. Calvin talked about traveling at the speed of light. You understand that, little Meg?" "Yes," Meg nodded. "That, of course, is the impractical long way around. We have learned to take shortcuts wherever possible." Having a side moment there saying, we know that that's not a good thing to do, but we'll just pretend that didn't happen. Don't teach that to children. No, anyway. "Sort of like in math?" Meg asked. "Like in math," Mrs. Watsit looked over at Mrs. Who. "Take your skirt and show them." "La experiencia es la madre de la ciencia. Spanish, my dears, Cervantes. Experience is the mother of knowledge." And it's really funny because Cervantes is reminding me of a video game that we used to play a lot, and I'm just letting it go now. Yes. Mrs. Who took a portion of her white robe in her hands and held it tight. "You see," Mrs. Watsit said, If a very small insect were to move from the section of skirt in Mrs. Hu's right hand to that in her left, it would be quite a long walk for him if he had to walk straight across. And now there is an illustration of an ant. Okay, an illustration of hands that are far apart holding a thread or a skirt or cloth and an insect on one side, walking along. Swiftly, Mrs. Hu brought her hands, still holding the skirt, together. "Now you see," Mrs. Watsit said, "he would be there without that long trip. That is how we travel." And now you've got the two hands holding the fabric or string close together, and the ants basically just walked on the hand, across the hand. Charles Wallace accepted the explanation serenely. Even Calvin did not seem perturbed. "Oh dear," Meg sighed, "I guess I am a b-. I just don't get it." "That is because you think of space only in three dimensions," Mrs. Watsit told her. "We travel in the fifth dimension. This is something you can understand, Meg. Don't be afraid to try. Was your mother able to explain a tesseract to you?" "Well, she never did," Meg said. "She got so upset about it. Why, Mrs. Watsit, she said it had something to do with her and father." "It was a concept they were playing with," Mrs. Watsit said. "Going beyond the fourth dimension to the fifth. Did your mother explain it to you, Charles?" "Well, yes." Charles looked a little embarrassed. "Please don't be hurt, Meg. I just kept at her while you were at school till I got it out of her." Meg sighed. "Just explain it to me." "Okay," Charles said. "What is the first dimension?" "Well, a line." So there's an image of a line. "Okay, and the second dimension?" "Well, you'd square the line. A flat square would be in the second dimension." And there's an image of a square. "And the third?" "Well, you would square the second dimension. Then the square wouldn't be flat anymore. It would have a bottom and sides and a top. So you have a cube." "And the fourth?" "Well, I guess if you want to put it into mathematical terms, you'd square the square, but you can't take a pencil and draw it the way you can the first three. I know it's got something to do with Einstein and time. I guess maybe you could call the fourth dimension time." "That's right," Charles said. "Good girl." Meantime, this is the younger brother and telling his older sister, "Good girl." Oof. Anyway, "Good girl." "Okay, then, for the fifth dimension, you'd square the fourth, wouldn't you?" "I guess so." "Well, the fifth dimension's a tesseract. You add that to the other four dimensions, and you can travel through space without having to go the long way around. In other words, to put it into Euclid, or old-fashioned plane geometry, a straight line is not the shortest distance between two points." For a brief illuminating second, Meg's face had the listening, probing expression that was so often seen on Charles's. "I see," she cried. "I got it. For just a moment, I got it. I can't possibly explain it now, but there for a second I saw it." She turned excitedly to Calvin. "Did you get it?" He nodded. "Enough. I don't understand it the way Charles Wallace does, but enough to get the idea." "So, now we go," Mrs. Witch said. "There is not all the time in the world." "Could we hold hands?" Meg asked. Calvin took her hand and held it tightly in his. "You can try," Mrs. Watsit said, "though I am not sure how it will work. You see, though we travel together, we travel alone. We will go first and take you afterward in the backwash. That may be easier for you." As she spoke, the great white body began to waver, the wings to dissolve into mist. Mrs. Hu seemed to evaporate until there was nothing but the glasses, and then the glasses too disappeared. It reminded Meg of the Cheshire Cat. "I've often seen a face without glasses," she thought, "but glasses without a face? I wonder if I go that way too, first me and then my glasses." She looked over at Mrs. Witch. Mrs. Witch was there, and then she wasn't. There was a gust of wind and a great thrust and a sharp shattering as she was shoved through what? Then darkness, silence, nothingness. If Calvin was still holding her hand, she could not feel it. But this time she was prepared for the sudden and complete dissolution of her body. When she felt the tingling come back to her fingertips, she knew that this journey was almost over, and she could feel again the pressure of Calvin's hand about hers. Without warning, coming as a complete and unexpected shock, She felt a pressure she had never imagined, as though she were being completely flattened out by an enormous steamroller. This was far worse than the nothingness had been. While she was nothing, there was no need to breathe. But now her lungs were squeezed together, so that although she was dying for want of air, there was no way for her lungs to expand and contract, to take in the air that she must have to stay alive. This was completely different from the thinning of atmosphere when they flew up the mountain, and she had to put the flowers to her face to breathe. She tried to gasp, but a paper doll can't gasp. She thought she was trying to think, but her flattened-out mind was as unable to function as her lungs. Her thoughts were squashed along with the rest of her. Her heart tried to beat. It gave a knife-like, sidewise movement, but it could not expand. But then she seemed to hear a voice, or if not a voice, at least words. Words flattened out like printed words on paper. "Oh, no, we can't stop here. This is a two-dimensional planet, and the children can't manage here." She was whizzed into nothingness again, and nothingness was wonderful. She did not mind that she could not feel Calvin's hand, that she could not see or feel or be. The relief from the intolerable pressure was all she needed. Then the tingling began to come back to her fingers, her toes. She could feel Calvin holding her tightly. Her heart beat regularly. Blood coursed through her veins. Whatever had happened, whatever mistake had been made, it was over now. She thought she heard Charles Wallace saying, his words round and full as spoken words ought to be, "Really, Mrs. Witch, you might have killed us." This time she was pushed out of the frightening fifth dimension with a sudden, immediate jerk. There she was, herself again, standing with Calvin beside her, holding onto her hand for dear life, and Charles Wallace in front of her, looking indignant. Mrs. Watsit, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch were not visible, but she knew that they were there. The fact of their presence was strong about her. "Children, I apologize," came Mrs. Witch's voice. "Now, Charles, calm down," Mrs. Watsit said, appearing not as the great and beautiful beast that she had been when they last saw her, but in her familiar wild garb of shawls and scarves, and the old tramp's coat and hat. "You know how difficult it is for her to materialize. If you are not substantial yourself, it is very difficult to realize how limiting protoplasm is." "I am sorry," Mrs. Witch's voice came again, but there was more than a hint of amusement in it. "It is not funny," Charles Wallace gave a childish stamp of his foot. Mrs. Who's glasses shone out, and as the rest of her appeared more slowly behind them, "We are such stuff as dreams are made of." She smiled broadly. "Prospero in the Tempest. I do like that play." "You didn't do it on purpose?" Charles demanded. "Oh, my darling, of course not," Mrs. Watsit said quickly. "It was just a very understandable mistake. It is very difficult for Mrs. Witch to think in a corporeal way. She wouldn't hurt you deliberately, you know that. And it's really a very pleasant little planet, and rather amusing to be flat. We always enjoy our visits there." "Where are we now, then?" Charles Wallace demanded, "and why?" "In Orion's Belt. We have a friend here, and we want you to have a look at your own planet." "When are we going home?" Meg asked anxiously. "What about Mother? What about the twins? They'll be terribly worried about us. When we didn't come in at bedtime, well, Mother must be frantic by now. She and the twins and Fort will have been looking and looking for us, and of course we aren't there to be found." "Now, don't worry, my pet," Mrs. Watsit said cheerfully. "We took care of that before we left. Your mother has enough to worry her with you and Charles to cope with, and not knowing about your father without our adding to her anxieties. We took a time wrinkle as well as a space wrinkle. It is very easy to do if you just know how." "What do you mean?" Meg asked plaintively. "Please, Mrs. Watsit, it's all so confusing." "Just relax and don't worry over things that needn't trouble you," Mrs. Watsit said. "We made a nice, tidy little time tester, and unless something goes terribly wrong, we'll have you back about 5 minutes before you left, so there'll be time to spare and nobody'll ever need to know that you were gone at all, though of course you'll be telling your mother, dear lamb, that she is. And if something goes terribly wrong, it won't matter whether we ever get back at all." "Don't frighten them," Mrs. Witch's voice came. "Are you losing faith?" "Oh, no. No, I'm not." But Meg thought her voice sounded a little faint. I hope this is a nice planet, Calvin said. We can't see much of it. Does it ever clear up? Meg looked around her, realizing that she had been so breathless from the journey and the stop on the two-dimensional planet that she had not noticed her surroundings. And perhaps this was not very surprising, for the main thing about the surroundings was exactly that they were unnoticeable. They seemed to be standing on some kind of nondescript flat surface. The air about them was gray. It was not exactly fog, but she could see nothing through it. Visibility was limited to the nicely definite bodies of Charles Wallace and Calvin, the rather unbelievable bodies of Mrs. Watsit and Mrs. Who, and a faint occasional glimmer that was Mrs. Witch. "Come, children," Mrs. Watsit said. "We don't have far to go, and we might as well walk. It will do you good to stretch your legs a little." As they moved through the greyness, Meg caught an occasional glimpse of slag-like rocks, but there were no traces of trees or bushes. Nothing but flat ground under their feet, no sign of any vegetation at all. Finally, ahead of them, there loomed what seemed to be a hill of stone. As they approached it, Meg could see that there was an entrance that led into a deep, dark cavern. "Are we going in there?" she asked nervously. "Don't be afraid," Mrs. Watsit said. "It's easier for the happy medium to work within. Oh, you'll like her, children. She's very jolly. If ever I saw her looking unhappy, I would be very depressed myself. As long as she can laugh, I'm sure everything is going to come out right in the end." "Mrs. Watsit," came Mrs. Witch's voice severely, "just because you are very young, it is no excuse for talking too much." Mrs. Watsit looked hurt, but she subsided. "Just how old are you?" Calvin asked her. "Just a moment," Mrs. Watsit murmured, and appeared to calculate rapidly on her fingers. She nodded triumphantly. "Exactly 2,379,152,497 years. 8 months and 3 days. That is according to your calendar, of course, which even you know isn't very accurate." She leaned closer to Meg and Calvin and whispered, "It was really a very great honor for me to be chosen for this mission. It's just because of my verbalizing and materializing so well, you know. But, of course, we can't take any credit for our talents. It's how we use them that counts, and I make far too many mistakes. That's why Mrs. Who and I enjoyed seeing Mrs. Witch make a mistake when she tried to land you on a two-dimensional planet. It was that we were laughing at, not at you. She was laughing at herself, you see. She's really terribly nice to us younger ones." Meg was listening with such interest to what Mrs. Watsit was saying that she hardly noticed when they went into the cave. The transition from the greyness of outside to the greyness of inside was almost unnoticeable. She saw a flickering light ahead of them, ahead and down, and it was towards this that they went. As they drew closer, she realized that it was a fire. "It gets very cold in here," Mrs. Watsit said, "so we asked her to have a good bonfire going for you." As they approached the fire, they could see a dark shadow against it, and as they went closer still, they could see that the shadow was a woman. She wore a turban of beautiful pale mauve silk and a long flowing purple satin gown. In her hands was a crystal ball into which she was gazing raptly. She did not appear to see the children, Mrs. Watsit, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch, but continued to stare into the crystal ball, and as she stared, she began to laugh. She laughed and laughed at whatever it was that she was seeing. Mrs. Witch's voice rang out clear and strong, echoing against the walls of the cavern, and the words fell with a sonorous clang. "We are here." The woman looked up from the ball, and when she saw them, she got up and curtsied deeply. Mrs. Watsit and Mrs. Who dropped small curtsies in return, and the shimmer seemed to bow slightly. "Oh, medium dear," Mrs. Watsit said, "these are the children. Charles Wallace Murray." Charles Wallace bowed. "Margaret Murray." Meg felt that if Mrs. Watsit and Mrs. Who had curtsied, she ought to also. So she did, rather awkwardly. "And Calvin O'Keefe." Calvin bobbed his head. "We want them to see their home planet," Mrs. Watsit said. The medium lost the delighted smile she had worn till then. "Oh, why must you make me look at unpleasant things when there are so many delightful ones to see?" Again Mrs. Witch's voice reverberated through the cave. There will no longer be so many pleasant things to look at if responsible people do not do something about the unpleasant ones. The medium sighed and held the ball high. Look, children, Mrs. Watsit said, look into it well. Que la terre est petite à qui la voit de sur, de l'île. How small is the earth to him who looks from heaven, Mrs. Hu intoned musically. Meg looked into the crystal ball, at first with caution, then with increasing eagerness, as she seemed to see an enormous sweep of dark and empty space, and then galaxies swinging across it. Finally, they seemed to move in closer on one of the galaxies. Your own Milky Way, Mrs. Watsit whispered to Meg. They were headed directly toward the center of the galaxy when they moved off to one side. Stars seemed to be rushing at them. Meg flung her arm over her face as though to ward off the blow. Look, Mrs. Witch commanded. Meg dropped her arm. They seemed to be moving in toward a planet. She thought she could make out polar ice caps. Everything seemed sparkling clear. No, medium dear, that's Mars, Mrs. Watsit reproved gently. Do I have to? The medium asked. Now, Mrs. Witch commanded. The bright planet moved out of their vision. For a moment there was the darkness of space, then another planet. The outlines of this planet were not clean and clear. It seemed to be covered with a smoky haze. Through the haze, Meg thought she could make out the familiar outlines of continents, like pictures in her social studies books. Is it because of our atmosphere that we can't see properly? She asked anxiously. No, Meg, you know that it is not the atmosphere, Mrs. Witch said. You must be brave. It's the thing, Charles Wallace cried. It's the dark thing we saw from the mountain peak on Uriel when we were riding it on Mrs. Watsit's back. Did it just come? Meg asked in agony, unable to take her eyes from the sickness of the shadow which darkened the beauty of the earth. Did it just come while we've been gone? Mrs. Witch's voice seemed very tired. Tell her, she said to Mrs. Watsit. Mrs. Watsit sighed. No, Meg, it hasn't just come. It has been there for a great many years. That is why your planet is such a troubled one. But why? Calvin started to ask, his voice croaking hoarsely. Mrs. Watsit raised her hand to silence him. We showed you the dark thing on Uriel first, oh, for so many reasons. First, because the atmosphere on the mountain peaks there is so clear and thin, you could see it for what it is. And we thought it would be easier for you to understand if you saw it, well, someplace else first, not your own Earth. I hate it, Charles Wallace cried passionately. I hate the dark thing. Mrs. Watsit nodded. Yes, Charles, dear, we all do. That's another reason we wanted to prepare you on Uriel. We thought it would be too frightening for you to see it first of all about your own beloved world. But what is it? Calvin demanded. We know that it's evil, but what is it? You have said it. Mrs. Witch's voice rang out. It is evil. It is the powers of darkness. What's going to happen? Meg's voice trembled. Oh, please, Mrs. Witch, tell us what's going to happen. We will continue to fight. Something in Mrs. Witch's voice made all three of the children stand straighter, throwing back their shoulders with determination, looking at the glimmer that was Mrs. Witch with pride and confidence. And we are not alone, you know, children, came Mrs. Watsit, the comforter. All through the universe, it's being fought. All through the cosmos, and my, but it's a grand and exciting battle. I know it's hard for you to understand about size, how there's very little difference in the size of the tiniest microbe to the greatest galaxy. You think about that, and maybe it won't seem strange to you that some